telehealth got a serious toehold into healthcare during the pandemic. Now it looks set to be a massive disruptor to the healthcare industry, powered by greater digitization and the use of AI. If it comes to its full potential, more people will be able to get better healthcare at affordable prices. The opportunity here is so massive that Amazon has been betting heavily on digitized healthcare with its One Medical service. But there's more to it than digitization, a lot more. I'm Jane Singer, and welcome back to A Seat at the Table. In each episode, we sit down with some of the smartest and most innovative people who join us as guests on this show and share a ton of valuable business and life-enhancing insights. A big shout out to all of our esteemed listeners around the world. Thank you for being here with us today. Today we're joined by Shanil Ibrahim, life science and healthcare leader at Deloitte Canada. He's had hands-on experience in the healthcare sector as a clinical epidemiologist, as well as an assistant professor at McMaster University and a researcher at Stanford University. Today, Shanil will be discussing how artificial intelligence is reshaping the landscape of patient care, how payers and providers are changing their models to focus more on value and patient outcomes, and whether technology can genuinely enhance patient experience and outcomes without depersonalizing care. While good medical care plays a key role in keeping us healthy, having the right people on our teams plays an equally vital role in the health of any business. Sometimes it only takes bringing in one talented executive to start to turn around a dying business into one that's financially healthy. Companies who are looking to find the kind of executive who can make a difference to their business look to AsiaNet Consultants. AsiaNet has over three decades of hands-on experience and a vast network that enables them to find the right people to fill even difficult-to-fill roles. To learn more about them, go to AsiaNetConsultants.com. That's AsiaNetConsultants.com. I'll also leave a link in the show notes for this episode. Now, you might be listening to this and thinking, I'd love to speak on a podcast, but you have no idea of how to make that happen. How do you actually land those guest spots? You wonder, how do other people do it? Actually, there's a simple six-step formula to landing guest spots on podcasts. Follow this and you will be able to start being a podcast guest almost immediately. I'll teach you exactly how to do this. You'll learn precisely what you need to do to reach out to podcast hosts, and more importantly, how to position yourself as a perfect guest. If you'd like to learn how to do this yourself, simply go to seat.fm/podcast course. That's seat.fm/podcast course. I'll leave a link in the show notes for this episode. And of course, these links and all the other links I've mentioned will be available over on our podcast website at seat.fm. Now, let's sit down with Shanil and find out what's happening with healthcare. Thank you so much for joining us here on A Seat at the Table. It's really a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
I think that what you're talking about is really interesting to an increasingly large group of people, because healthcare affects all of us. And now with the advent of more technology, in particular AI, there's even more conversation, right, around sort of the combination of health and technology. And we saw some of that during the pandemic, right, when we were forced to do everything online. You saw a lot more people doing medical consultations, for example, virtually, and some of that has continued on. So I think it's really interesting to hear what your views are on this. Perhaps we could start right with the elephant in the room, which is AI, and how that might be reshaping the landscape of patient care, and also what ethical considerations do we need to consider as we're combining a lot more technology with a lot of things that are quite personal and sensitive information.
That's a great question, Jane. And AI is something I've been thinking about for quite a while. I've been leading our practice at Deloitte at Health AI for a number of years. And through that, I had interactions with a lot of organizations around what does AI mean for the organization, right? And AI is truly reshaping patient care. It's offering us a lot of tools and insights that we were honestly, at one point, we thought it was truly out of reach for the layperson. But we're seeing everything from AI predicting patient health trends to enhancing early detection of diagnoses with incredible accuracy, whether you have cancer, whether you have diabetes, whether you have heart conditions. And this is allowing us to intervene and manage patients early. But Jane, this isn't, you know, using tech just for the sake of tech. It's truly about making a genuine difference in how we care for patients. But of course, like you mentioned, there's a lot of considerations that we have. And as we dive deeper into integrating AI into healthcare, we're very conscious of the ethical side of things. So first of all, it's critical to ensure patient data, which is actually powering AI, is handled with the utmost care, which is why we enforce privacy and security measures for anyone handling patient-sensitive data. And the second thing that we also notice is that the use of AI for you and I to really trust any sort of machine, it needs to be transparent. It can't be a black box. We can't just see it recommending things on how to manage patients if we don't know what's going on. So anything that we need to look at needs to be transparent in that sense. And then the data and the AI machine and whatever it is that spits out this information, it needs to be based on equitable data. And what I mean by that is there's a lot of biases in the data that we've been collecting for a number of years. And when we use AI that is prone to biases, it provides us recommendations that's also prone to biases, right? A great example is, you know, we all end up using ChatGPT and things along those lines. And there's a great scenario, and they probably corrected it by now, but if you end up writing a healthcare history and you say a male clinician ended up seeing the patient, it thinks it's a doctor. If you end up writing with a female clinician, it thinks it's a nurse. And it's a great way of a bias that ends up being perpetuated through these type of applications. So these are the things that we need to think about in terms of ethical considerations that need to be front and center. And we're talking about safeguarding privacy, eliminating biases, and just being transparent across the board if we truly want to be responsible in the use.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And certainly, as you're pointing out, a lot of AI or large language is based on what's already known. And that, in a sense, perhaps has a bias that things that aren't already known might be not considered as carefully as if you have a very good practitioner, an individual, a human looking at things. I'm just wondering, I mean, we all look at AI as being so incredibly radically new, and yet on the one hand it is, and on the other hand, technology has been used in healthcare increasingly for a very long time, right? When, you know, originally from x-rays all the way through to, you know, far more advanced ways of MRI and other kinds of scanning and other kinds of testing that can be done. Why is AI, do you feel, seen as, instead of just an enhancement on the existing technology, which has been progressing, how do you feel it is, or maybe you don't think it is, massively a game changer?
It is definitely a game changer. And you're right, technology has been used in healthcare for a very, very long time now, right? And we use it for any sort of machines, whether it's surgical devices that we end up having. We use it for electronic medical records. And in a lot of cases, it was very clear that a clinician or a nurse is front and center using those technologies. So technologies is there to enable the person. AI is really changing that because we're getting a little bit more, for lack of a better term, autonomous. We're not there fully yet in certain cases in healthcare, but we're getting more and more there. So if you had a surgery done, let's say a neurosurgery, right now there's a surgeon actually doing it, and they will be using some sort of machine, and you're going to use a variety of different machines to be able to do that surgery. At one point, they will end up having robot assistants. Then is it a case where a robot would end up doing it and a neurosurgeon just oversees it? And at one point, would you actually end up getting a surgery done on your brain and is fully autonomous by a surgeon? That's the questions that we're having, right? And it does, you know, when I'm talking about it, and I don't know if you feel like this, but there's a lot of people who are like, I don't know if I'll ever get there. I don't think I'll ever end up basically trusting a surgical robot. But these are the same questions we're having in other areas. Think about autonomous cars. We're having the exact same questions around it. And the problem with AI compared to any other technology is we have a much higher threshold, or should I say, much lower threshold in terms of the errors that it can make. So if you're in a car and there's multiple accidents every single day that's done by humans, autonomous cars or cars that are driven by AI are already safer than humans. But if one crash happens on the road, that is a scrutiny that you will hear about all the time because we don't know why it has exactly happened. Can it happen? Did we not get this right? So the error rate is it has to be 100% error free at one point in time. And it's the same thing we expect out of healthcare, which is why the conversations are very, very different when an AI comes in, because we just don't have the same level of trust that we have with other technologies or even with just human instincts, by the way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think also, though, that when it comes particularly to healthcare, because you're talking about something that the ill effects might be irreversible or could have terrible consequences, people definitely feel more sensitive about that. I think people are probably more interested in technology or more comfortable with technology where it's more assisting a human as opposed to replacing a human. They feel that if you have a human there, there might be a little bit of, I don't know what you would call it, a buffer, that if things go wrong, someone could correct it. Whereas if you're completely relying on the, the machine or the software to do its thing and something goes wrong, well, who's there to sort of put on the brakes or correct? So I think, maybe for, in a very positive way, we have more faith in the capabilities of human beings. Then perhaps we realize.
Absolutely right. And Jane, like you said, with humans, you understand a human. There's a trust. You innately we have we know humans are prone to errors or biases, and we are okay in to some degree. With AI, you assume they should be error-free, they should be bias-free. And if AI is directly affecting patient health outcomes or safety in some sort of manner, there's a mistrust. And as soon as you have mistrust in any sort of device, you no longer end up using it. And so the bar is much, much higher when it comes to AI versus anything else, for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you mentioned that the adoption of health tech, while it's accelerating, there is the risk of what you call a digital divide, right? That maybe this kind of technology is not equally available across all patient populations. I think that's an interesting point because I had another person on this show who was in health tech who had brought up the idea that actually this digitization was going to make it more available to a wider percent of the population. So, what do you see happening around that?
Great question. So we've seen a rapid adoption of health tech, and I'm a huge proponent of health tech. And I think if anything, we're still under service and under adopted when it comes to this. But you're right; it poses a pretty big risk in terms of widening the digital divide, especially among different socioeconomic groups. And rural versus urban, where you don't see health technology widely available. And from what I observed, ensuring equitable access is pretty multifaceted, but it's entirely possible with concerted efforts that we put in. And it needs, both the private sector and the public sector really to come together. And the first element around making sure we don't see any sort of digital divide is, ensuring we're investing in the right infrastructure, which means investing in and expanding broadband internet access to rural and underserved areas. This is foundational. And this is something we've seen in low and middle income countries where they have massive initiatives to make internet widely accessible everywhere. Because without reliable internet, any benefits that we're talking about with health technology, whether it's telehealth or digital health platforms, it becomes inaccessible, right? And if it's not accessible, we're creating barriers to be able to use these tools where we can gain a lot of benefits. So the way I look at it, it's almost like you can't end up providing everyone a car, but not providing highways or roads. Right? You're going to create those type of barriers along the way. And that's similar to how we end up basically seeing with internet access to power these devices. Another part of accessibility is affordability, which means we need to be able to still subsidize the cost of wearable devices for low-income populations to make a huge difference. And a lot of health technologies, if you think about things like an Apple Watch, for example, that's fantastic. They're fantastic devices, but not everyone can fork out $1,000+ to invest in this. So how are we making those easily accessible? And that's where private sector and government health programs really need to come in to remove the cost barriers as well. And once we kind of take care of all of this, it comes back to your point around the whole digital divide. We need to be doing everything in our power to bridge these gaps to push the population to be able to use these technologies going forward. So that's how I basically see it.
I think it's interesting when you're looking at it from that point of view. And it seems to me that, of course, the Apple Watch is sort of the very high end, you know, the pinnacle, right, of wearable technology. But there's a lot of other things that I've seen coming through that are simpler, right, that may not be quite as fancy. But in terms of being able to put sensors, for example, in garments that people wear close to their skin to be able to monitor anything from heart rate to glucose levels to any number of different things that need to be monitored, that could potentially be much more affordable and be very interesting. How do you see, when you look at it, at you know, being able to use technology to reach people across a much wider span, whether it be economic or whether it be geographic, you know, one case that has been brought forward is that because we can do a lot more online with health, it's enabling people who are outside of major metropolitan areas to have better access from the point of view that doctors can do things online and help these people. And they'll be able to do that without having to travel a long distance to get to see a specialist. What do you see happening around that?
A fantastic question, and quite timely as well, right? Because the whole idea of remote care technologies, which is essentially us using these technologies from a distance to provide care to patients, was not as well adopted previously. But that really changed during the pandemic, which forced us to look at virtual care means, telehealth means, as well as remote care, and think about it very, very differently. So now we've seen it really proliferate, not just in our country, but also globally as well. And this is where I think there's a lot of opportunity, because telehealth, what it has actually done is it has provided us as access to doctors who we weren't able to get access to before, whether you are in remote communities, whether you're in rural communities, whether you're just in places that you're just not able to access them to the same degree, especially given the fact that some of the really specialized care we're talking about, and I'm thinking about like cancer, when you're in advanced stage cancer and you need a specific type of cell therapy and gene therapy and some sort of monitoring that's being done, you have to go to an academic center, which are these large hospitals, which are thousands and thousands of kilometers and miles away. And that creates a significant barrier. So now introducing technology like telehealth can allow us to see a clinician much, much faster. But we were just talking about wearables, for example, and that's where remote care really comes into play. So what I really love about some of these facilities, even if you end up going in person, you still need to monitor them every week or every couple of weeks. And this is where you can end up setting up those devices in a person's home and be able to monitor them, and a physician's able to communicate with the patient right away. And now we're starting to see significant advancements when it comes to that, to truly augment healthcare delivery, which is foundational in terms of providing that equitable, accessible care as well. So I think we have just scratched the surface when it's really come to this, because now with those things that I've talked about around the internet access and providing affordable technologies, I feel we're moving into a world where we're going to go away from the hospital and back into the home, where a majority of our healthcare needs is going to be done at the comfort of our own home. And that's going to change the whole paradigm in terms of the investments that we make in this ecosystem. And I'm particularly excited to see where it's exactly going to go as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting shift because there, of course, in North America, we see more things done on an outpatient basis. The idea of trying to either not have you stay in the hospital or stay there as little as possible, mainly because of the risk of picking up infections and things like that. So more things are being done by sending the patient home. And yet, as you're pointing out, you don't necessarily have that great way of monitoring them when they're not on site. So to be able to bridge that gap is really game changing. Now, how do you see providers changing their models to focus more on value and on patient outcomes? Because I think that's a part of the equation that a lot of people are wrestling with is to see how do we manage, something that's very complex and try to get to better outcomes in something with a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, this has been a slow climb into moving towards the right direction, because in the healthcare sector, and particularly in the context of our work at Deloitte, we're observing a significant pivot from what we call traditional fee-for-service models, where you end up paying for every service that a provider provides, to those value-based frameworks. And the transition fundamentally changes the game for payers and providers to align any sort of financial incentives, so any sort of payments, with the quality of patient outcomes rather than the quantity of services delivered, which makes intuitive sense, right? Like, I shouldn't be charging the patient or charging the government, if it's a universal healthcare system, for just providing a whole bunch of services if we don't know if it's going to provide any benefits. And to me, this is a promising shift towards those healthier populations and sustainable healthcare systems. But providers, on their part, are embracing these models in pockets, I would say, because it's different than how they have typically done things in the past. Because it makes sense, when I end up providing a service, I end up getting certain money. But now you are thinking about the overall population and the patient outcome, and that's might be a little bit more difficult to measure. So a lot of things need to come into play. Like, what does a good outcome start to look like? How do I know I have full control of that outcome as well? Because I may be able to provide a service, but you as a patient are doing so many other things to end up getting healthier. So I need to have control and collect the right type of information to get there. This is where it comes back to appropriate patient engagement. We have digital health platforms that collect that information. There needs to be regular communication to manage the health condition. There's an onus back on the patient to self-manage some parts of it as well. And so, as you can imagine, this transition is not without its challenges. And until we have those robust data platforms that can track and analyze patient health outcomes accurately, we're still going to see a slower progress into getting that. And I think that's going to be a big shift. And as I mentioned, the other big thing is a lot of our healthcare providers are still an older population. So you're going to see an organizational culture change that's happening from that volume-based mindset to a value-based mindset, which means, more retraining. You got to redefine roles and restructure what we think about healthcare. And I'm still optimistic we're moving towards the right direction. And I applaud payers, these are both government and private payers, to put that pressure on the system to get there. And then once we get there, I truly feel that healthcare can actually be much more sustainable, because we're in a very costly system right now, Jane.
Yes, absolutely. I think that healthcare right now is sort of facing that, I don't know if you want to call it a tipping point or a certain point where things have to shift, because you're making some very good points here that I don't know who's winning, right? Because it's very expensive, certainly in the US where I'm from, for patients. Doctors feel they're not getting the compensation, right? When healthcare facilities, hospitals, and so forth feel they're not getting compensated properly. Nobody seems to really feel like they're winning out of all of this. So I think what you're working on is really important and, can hopefully find a solution.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is where we understand it's a paradigm shift, just in the way that we have always done things. And with any paradigm shift, it's not going to end up happening overnight. So a lot of people may be getting frustrated that why is this taking long? We've been talking about value-based healthcare for a very, very long time. But you start to see this happening in pockets, few initiatives being implemented at a time. And at one point, we're just getting to that tipping point where it will tip. And once it tips, we're going to look backwards at fee for service and think to ourselves, why did we ever do it like this? This never made sense. But until we as a society are getting used to the way that the new way is going to provide us better outcomes, which make it much more sustainable and makes it easier for the patient and the provider. Yeah, it's going to take some time to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it will take probably a lot longer than any of us would like. But I think that the fact that it's being addressed is a step in the right direction. I think that before everyone was complaining about it, and now it seems like at least people are trying to see how can we move forward on this. So I really appreciate your bringing that up. Now, you brought up so many interesting things, Chenille. How can people get in touch with you? I think a lot of people may want to reach out to you. They might have questions of their own. Is there a way people can connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. There are different ways as well. I think one of the best ways is to find me on LinkedIn. I end up posting a lot of different articles, both done by me personally as well as those that are provided by Deloitte. We've put out a lot of global health outlooks in terms of what's happening for the next year, as well as what's happening for 2040. So that's one. I also end up speaking a lot, whether it's through podcast, conferences, and I also write a lot of op-eds. So these are different ways that you can always find me, and I'm always responsive to any sort of inquiry that really kind of comes my way as well. So that's probably the best way to actually get a hold of me.
Oh, perfect. Well, I'm going to put the links in the show notes for this episode, and I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Jane, and really enjoyed our conversation.